We come to the last part of the agenda for this symposium. Once again, we have a very straightforward, simple title: Bullying, Harassment, and the Civil Rights of People with Disabilities. Astonishing that you can get so much into so few words. We have three people to present on this panel. The first is a senior parent educator advocate from the PACER Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The PACER Center is a training center for parents and educators and advocates. Here is Susan Einspar.
Introduction. Thank you. And on the final day, love the enthusiasm. This is great. Thank you so much for inviting me. I am so impressed by everyone that I have met and every session that I have attended. It's really very different than most other conferences that I have attended, in the sense that someone's not up there just talking about the law and the recent cases, but you're getting a lot of practical information, and that's what I'm here for. But I also think that's an awesome, tremendous way of doing a conference, because what we really need to know is not what the law says, but how we can use the law to our advantage. PACER Center, as he mentioned, is a parent training and information center. We are the largest, I believe, in the country, and one of the oldest, if not the oldest. We have over 40 different programs, ranging from our advocacy program to our assistive technology program, transition program, Count Me in Puppets, children's mental health. So we cover a wide range of issues related to primarily students with disabilities. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Approximately 5 million children are bullied every year. And two-thirds of all children who are bullied have a disability. That's staggering. So let's talk about why that occurs and how we can address it practically. First of all, what is bullying? Because a lot of times the parent will approach the school district, and the school district will say, oh, that's teasing, or that's this, or particularly with children with autism, they'll say, oh, but he misunderstood. Or I've had teachers actually say, when Johnny comes up and says, they said I'm bothering them. Well, you are kind of annoying, Johnny. That's not the response that we want at all. And of course, in that classroom, one person described it to me as a village. And it is. And who's the leader of that village that everyone follows? The teacher. So really, that's the person that you need to have on your side. It's not always obvious, as I mentioned, that bullying is taking place. It's not always the person getting beat up, which is easy to identify. It is, we have cyberbullying. We have now what we call shunning, which is the child who sits alone at the lunch table. That's a form of bullying. It's not just that that child is not welcome by their peer group. Bullying, the difference between conflict and bullying is power. And so when you look at a bullying situation, you have to look at, is there an imbalance of power? An imbalance of power can be anything from size to social credibility and social power or intellect. And so that's what we're looking at, because we are looking at control issues. And when we expect children to address these issues themselves, like we typically did when we grew up, it gives that other individual typically more power. If we say ignore them, then what we find is, that's a reaction. They like that reaction. And frankly, if ignoring the other child was going to work, we wouldn't have a problem, because that's the very first thing kids try to do, is ignore it or stand up for themselves. Some of the things we need to do are empower the child, not to take care of the problem, but to help the child understand that this is the responsibility of the adults, but we also want to empower them. Okay. One other thing. It is not resolved by restorative justice. That's not the issue. So if anyone in this room thinks that getting children together to talk about their issues is the way to handle it, it's not. That's like asking an abused woman to go to marriage counseling with her abuser. It doesn't work. It actually typically increases the abuse. It's also important for us as disability advocates to understand that it is important to address the needs of both the child who's engaging in bullying behavior and the child who's the recipient of it. There are many reasons why children bully. Some of them just for social credibility, some of them because they really don't understand the consequences of it and they're mimicking someone else. Or what I often see is reactive bullying. And that is, okay, I've had it, now I'm going after you because I've learned this from you. I always tell them, because I'm from Minnesota, I tell a child, well, you know, when you play hockey and somebody fouls you, you get right back at them, right? Well, who goes into the penalty box? You do. So it's important that children feel safe and are safe in school. And I've talked to groups and I've said, look, guys, maybe you're right. Maybe this child who's on the spectrum is misinterpreting the social situation. But we need to first make them feel safe. Validate that this hurts them and that they are powerless to stop it. And then perhaps we can go on to teaching those social skills that they're misinterpreting. But the very first thing we need to do is help that child to feel welcome in the community. So, one of the things that we use is a student action plan. It's a student action plan. I have lots of handouts on the back table that you can help yourself to. The student action plan is really the parent or the teacher just fills out, this is what's happening, and this is what I want to happen. Parents often call me, and of course, they want the bully's head on a silver platter. They didn't expel him, they didn't suspend him. And so one of the things I have to say is, well, first of all, we need to focus on your child. And I can't focus on that other child. I don't know that situation, but I want your child to feel safe and to be safe. We, as a policy at PACER, avoid litigation and attorneys, especially with school districts. Sorry, guys. But We do everything to avoid that. We use every tool in our box to work with a school district so that we can resolve those issues at the district. As you heard yesterday, when you go to a judge, you're going to a single individual that very often you have to educate. And if you fail in that education or somewhere else, as one federal judge once told me, well, we decide what we want the decision to be, and then we tell our clerk to write it. That's important to know, because as a naive attorney, when I first came out, I thought the law ruled. Yeah, I hear some laughter. It doesn't. It does not. You need to be persuasive, and hopefully you can, through most of your toolboxes, which is mediation, go to mediation whenever possible. We have an advantage in Minnesota. We have, prior to going to due process, we have other tools. We have conciliation, mediation, and what we call a facilitated IEP meeting, which many states don't have. And those are wonderful tools to have. When you go into a meeting with the school district, one of the most important things to do is your preparation. Now, you may say, well, yeah, obviously. But by preparation, I mean preparing the parent and sometimes the child. I ask them to prepare a wish list. What if you could have anything you wanted? What's your wish list? And then we work on that wish list, what's practical, what they're going to do. And let me tell you, too, I've been surprised by school districts agreeing to do things that they're not obligated to do, so long as the school district attorney isn't there. Because it's his job to earn his fee. And earning his fee to many, not all, school district attorneys, is being able to say no and justifying it. So we have our wish list. We have our examples before we go in. And then I don't bring case law, but I bring the Dear Colleague letter regarding bullying and harassment. I bring OCR decisions. But I don't like to bring case law because then they think attorney. And they go back to their attorney. Now, you may say, well, how do you get away with that, Susan? You're an attorney. We are actually advocates. And I do not develop an attorney-client relationship. That's what we say. And we are representing them as lay advocates. And we're getting away with it so far. And in fact, school districts will say, well, you know, I know, Susan, I know you're admitted to practice. I know you've done this for many years. We want our attorney there. And I'll say, well, then I can't be there. Because I'm not representing the parent as an attorney. That's a disadvantage to the attorney, to the parent. And the school districts will typically say, oh, okay then. Sometimes when I know their attorney, they'll say, nah, Susan, that's not going to work because you know more than the school district does, and I don't want you there, so that works for me. But that's not very often. So we use for children with disabilities 504 and the IEP to address bullying. You'd be surprised. We do presentations around the country, and we do workshops throughout our state by the number of teachers and administrators who say, really, how do you do that through the IEP? Where does that go? Well, with a child who is seeing miscues, it may be a goal and social work services. In addition to the accommodations and modifications, No child wants to be stuck with a para, even if their parents want it. They typically don't want it by their side. So we do recommend what we call shadowing. And shadowing is making sure that there is an adult within listening distance at all times who can intervene or at least report to administration. In terms of litigation, we have found that OCR is very responsive. And one of the things I like about OCR is that they typically have an attorney who answers calls. Every day they assign a different attorney. So I call them up and I'm like, well, what do you think of this? And you know, you can't call the judge up and say, what do you think of this, and get a feel for where they're at. But you can call OCR up. And in fact, I did on one case where I said, well, you know, the DOJ has this opinion out there that says X. Oh, yeah, that sounds like the Department of Justice, all right. We're different. We get the issues. So it's a helpful tool to use. We always begin, as we discussed yesterday, by finding common ground. And the common ground, obviously, is that, especially in elementary school, but everywhere, every child needs to feel safe and be safe. And you don't want bullying going on in the school. So how can we problem solve this as a group? And engaging the school with the problem solving process, and often engaging the student in that as well. I'll tell you a story about one precocious child on the spectrum, Johnny.
2 minutes.
Thank you. And I'm at the end too. Johnny. Johnny came to his IEP meeting to address the fact that he was being shunned, that no one, you know, talked to him or played with him or ate lunch with him. And so the group engaged Johnny in the process. And Johnny said, you know, how about you let me have a VIP table in the lunchroom, and everybody I invite to the VIP table who sits with me and talks with me gets an extra dessert. The school said, oh, okay, yeah, that'll work. We can try that for a couple weeks. The important thing is also to come back within a few weeks to see that things are working. Came back within a few weeks, and Johnny said, yeah, things are working, but I haven't had an opportunity to meet everybody in my class. So, Mom, can you come to school? And of course, wow, Mom is like, yeah, what can I do for you? Well, bring, what do they call them, the McDonald's kids meals. Bring hot Happy Meals for kids at my VIP table. And you know, this child really solved the issue for himself and made many friends within that classroom. So it's surprising what individuals can do. As I finish, I want to thank you very much for everything that you do every day. And I also want to remind you that as frustrating as it can be about where we are today, we've come a long way. And the quote I use in demonstrating that is the school district attorney in Brown versus Board of Education, who said, if we allow these children in our schools, next thing you know, they'll be asking us to let the disabled students in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. We now hear from Victoria Rodriguez Roldan, who is Senior Policy Counsel. And Justice Project and Disability Justice Director of the National LGBTQ Task Force. Here is Victoria Rodriguez-Roldan. There you go.
It even works. And thank you for the introduction and for having me here today. A lot of my work centers, I'm the Director of Disability Justice at the National LGBTQ Task Force, and our mission is to be the progressive voice of the LGBT movement and the LGBT voice of the progressive movement. As such, the Disability Justice Project was created trying to flip that into the disability movement, trying to be the disability voice of the LGBT movement and the LGBT voice of the disability movement. From a progressive intersectional perspective of disability justice and not just disability rights, which can be a somewhat limiting perspective, as many have pointed out, for example, in the brilliant session by one of my former fellows, Lydia Brown, a few minutes ago. I would point out a lot of the work on harassment and bullying that we have done centers around LGBTQ and trans issues. For example, 70% of transgender respondents within the U.S. Trans Survey in 2015 reported being a victim of harassment or bullying or other forms of assault and of discrimination within a workplace. In schools, the statistic is almost as high. And many have been forced out of school and so forth. Approximately a third of our respondents were identified as people with disability. More were identified because they didn't mark that they identified as having a disability, but they marked questions such as being visibly impaired and whatnot. This number is probably underreporting because it didn't really ask about mental health disabilities. For the record, I wasn't part of the drafting of that document. That was before my time. It would have those questions if I had drafted it. When it comes to that, it becomes essentially a major disability issue. And I would like to see it from an approach, because what we see a lot is that bullying, harassment in schools especially, only really gets addressed when there is privilege involved. When it depends on the school district, it depends on the resources that the school wants to provide. And one thing we need to keep in mind, much like when we talk about police being responsible for a lot of the law enforcement problems that we have and militarization, the same thing happens in schools. A lot of this bullying is happening with the tacit or explicit protection of the school by not doing anything, basically, by being part of it. In some cases, we have seen bullying committed by teachers or discrimination by teachers, and almost everyone who has practiced around the educational space and trying to achieve Olmsted integration and enforcement of IEP plans and non-discrimination there should know this at this point, which is that oftentimes the school is the worst case. It creates, if I'm going to cite the comic, the question of who watches the Watchmen, essentially. I really hope this crowd is nerdy enough to get that reference. If not, you know. But that is one major problem. Likewise, when we move into harassment in the workplace and in other spaces, the same thing happens where the workplace will end up going forward in not protecting the person with the disability. It will either be part of the discrimination, Much like in schools, it will often say something along the lines of, if you were more normal, you wouldn't be facing this. And I've seen this happen in schools. In workplaces, when it comes to sexual harassment, we see the punishing of employees for speaking out. They're the ones that end up getting fired or punished. We see this discrimination happen among LGBTQ people, and we should start seeing there are many who are starting to use the ADA as a way to protect the trans community, using the gender dysphoria diagnosis as a disability. Talk to me more if you want to be linked up to practitioners who are using that as a method. There was actually a decision on that in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania in Philly. But that's besides the point. We have, likewise, I think a lot, for example, one case we saw is basically that the person felt being a disabled trans person when the U.S. Trans Survey was drafted, who felt compelled into trying to go on disability because of the amount of trouble that they felt getting into getting employment and sustaining it because of the harassment they were facing, both because of their mental health disability and because of their gender identity. We need to see also this as a form. I am going to go contrary to my prior speaker with all the respect in the world for your work, which is that we do need to find alternatives, regardless of whether we want to call it restorative justice or other forms of justice. We need to find alternatives that aren't punitive. We need to find alternatives. We are seeing far too many police officers being sent to schools, not enough counselors. We need to start having a discussion that doesn't necessarily put the bullier in prison, but tries to reform and restore and change the situation that isn't punitive. Because what we see is that in schools that are predominantly of color, that are in underserved communities and poor communities, what we see is criminalization because someone pushed someone, because someone threw a snowball. And I don't know if you've seen children. They're some of the cruelest people on earth. Seriously. And in that sense, we need to start seeing justice measures that do well by the person who is being bullied, try to correct the situation, but that do not try to derail anyone from it. We need to stop seeing because far too often when it comes to disability, we have to stop seeing contained classrooms and shunting out persons with disability into individual settings or into segregated settings, which is the other thing we're seeing, as a way to quote-unquote protect them from the bullying. No, that is victim blaming. That is the equivalent of saying, why were you wearing that? Or why were you out at that time of night? We wouldn't say that. I sincerely hope you wouldn't from you and the audience. And that is the equivalent of that. We're far too often blaming the student for being different. The schools are expecting the student to try to conform in order to avoid the bullying, and oftentimes are being precisely shunted out by the school into that bullying situation. One situation I've seen is precisely where students start doing that bullying because the school essentially is outing them by the accommodations that they're getting, by not being confidential enough. And obviously this is illegal, but it happens. By being made more self-aware of they're being behind in a grade and so forth. And likewise, when we see an LGBTQ students, for example, trans students being outed because the professor or teacher will not use their preferred name or gender pronouns, and that in turn creates a safety issue within the school from other students. Likewise, we need to start seeing bullying as the threat that it is. And in harassment cases, we need to start seeing it also as the barrier it is for employment of people with disabilities, as the form of discrimination that it is, and so forth. We need to start seeing it as a major national problem that goes beyond disability, that intersects with race, that intersects with gender, that intersects with sexual orientation and gender identity, and so forth and so forth. In that sense, we cannot see, we far too often see disability, racial justice, prison reform, LGBTQ issues as these separate, specific, easily segregated different areas of advocacy, when in reality they're more of a single big ball of wibbly wobbly activisty whiny stuff, basically. The sentence got away from me there, but you get the point. We need to see the problem as an intersectional one. We need to keep cooperating with other advocates, and we need to stop isolating ourselves as disability advocates. We need to start working with other communities that are facing bullying and harassment. We need to keep working on that front and ensuring that kind of competency. And we need to stop seeing disability advocacy as something separate, as not a racial justice problem, as not a problem that affects people of color. And frankly, the fact that yesterday there was only a single speaker of color in this conference says that we still have work to do on that front. You can clap more at the risk of sounding like Jeb Bush there. Before I finish, that is essentially my plea. We are seeing, we need to also blame the schools. We need to also see who is being the victim of bullying when it comes to disability and how it intersects with other identities, because we have to be all of us all the time, which is the latest slogan my employer has come up with. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Victoria. We will now hear from a professor of law at Suffolk University and the director of the New Workplace Institute at the university. He is a globally recognized authority on workplace bullying and psychological abuse. Here is David Yamada.
I think I'm the last speaker too, so hopefully I won't encourage people to stampede to the exits, and rather you'll want to hang around and listen to a little bit about what I'd like to share with you. First, I'd like to say I got here late yesterday morning. This is my first opportunity to attend this conference. It has been very educational to me. Very informative. I've taken so many notes and thought about a lot of things that, frankly, I needed to think about and hadn't thought about before. So I want to thank people for sharing so much of your work and your insights, because it's just such valuable work that everyone is doing. I want to talk about bullying in the workplace. And so I'm going to talk about sort of the general dynamics of bullying in the workplace, what it does to people and organizations, the legal issues that surround workplace bullying and attempts to create legal reform, and then to tie it back into some broader issues that have been raised at this conference and elsewhere in terms of just a broader frame on human dignity. About 20 years ago, I read an online interview with a social psychologist named Gary Namy, and he and his wife Ruth were in the process of starting something they called the Campaign Against Workplace Bullying. They were based in California at the time, and they had incorporated this term or imported this term from England, where a journalist named Andrea Adams had identified just this cluster of behaviors, and the Brits are very fond of using that term bullying to describe aggressive behavior towards others. And so Andrea Adams just labeled it workplace bullying. And they said, that's really what we're going to use too. The Namys decided to incorporate that term. And as Gary was talking in that interview, he decided to really sort of set out the basics of what workplace bullying is about. And he said, look, it's repeated, it's health harming, it's mistreatment of one or more persons in the workplace by one or more perpetrators. And it is abusive conduct that is threatening, that is humiliating or intimidating. It interferes and undermines the ability of people to do their jobs. And it is often a form of really severe targeted abuse. Well, what are we talking about in terms of concrete behaviors? It's really a sort of a laundry list of direct and indirect or covert or overt behaviors, such as false accusations of mistakes, the proverbial yelling and screaming boss, intimidating nonverbal behaviors, exclusion and the silent treatment. Susan mentioned a little bit about ostracism and what it does to kids. Well, the same thing can happen to people in the workplace. Sabotage and undermining of a target's work performance and reputation. The use of put-downs, insults, excessively harsh criticism, unreasonably heavy work demands designed to ensure someone's failure on the job. This is just sort of, I guess, the short list of some of the behaviors that we call bullying in the workplace. Maybe some of you have seen it. Maybe some of you have experienced it. If you have, then, you know, at a gut level, you know what I'm talking about. Unfortunately, there's a lot of it in the legal profession, as some of you know. Well, how frequent is this behavior? I would go so far as to say it is one of the probably the most significant neglected problems in the American workplace. Survey data, reliable survey data, indicates that roughly 25 or 30% of the workforce will experience some form of targeted bullying during their work lives. We know that at least in the United States, workplace bullying tends to be a top-down dynamic. It is usually from supervisor to subordinate. The perpetrators, by a roughly 6-to-4 margin, are male. At times, there are more than one bully involved in this, and sometimes we call that mobbing, where you see groups of coworkers ganging up on someone they happen not to like for various reasons. The term workplace mobbing also came to us from Europe, and it was based, actually, the term was drawn from scientists who had observed the behaviors of birds descending upon an unpopular member of the flock, and they said, well, we're seeing a lot of this in terms of how workers can treat one another. Dr. Kudlick, one of the earlier panels, talked about the importance of culture. And I submit to you that workplace bullying does not occur in a vacuum. It is enabled and sometimes perpetrated from the top and the organizational cultures that are established in an institution. If you want to read a great paper, look up Dr. Linda Hartling and Dr. Elizabeth Sparks. They wrote a paper on relational and non-relational workplace cultures. Relational workplace cultures are healthy cultures where people try to communicate, work through their differences, enable one another, treat each other with dignity and respect. The non-relational cultures are the types of cultures that stoke bullying at work. The dog-eat-dog, zero-sum type of workplace. Or, and this is the more interesting form of non-relational culture, what they called the pseudo-relational culture, where everyone tries to be superficially nice to one another, while the seething anger and disagreements and conflicts are just buried to the point where, you know, then they usually get expressed in very passive-aggressive ways. If you want an analogy, just think of a very dysfunctional family sitting around the table at Thanksgiving, and because they don't get along with each other, about all they can talk about is whether they prefer cranberry sauce or dressing, because if they get beyond that, they're going to, you know, bad stuff is going to start getting thrown around verbally, or maybe food fights or something like that. But in any event, both of those types of cultures, the more aggressive dog-eat-dog culture and that non-relational or that pseudo-relational culture, can really stoke the types of behaviors that I'm talking about. For those who are targeted by this behavior, we know that the effects can be significant, especially those who are really under attack. Stress and anxiety, depression, PTSD-type symptoms, suicidal ideation. While we know that suicide is a very complicated topic, we do also know that there have been suicides associated with bullying-type behaviors at work. And with that, obviously, in a more, quote, practical way, comes severe damage to one's career and career prospects and ability to pursue a livelihood. Some people ask me, you know, how bad can it get? And I've seen just these situations that are, first, they're sort of irrational because there's no reason why the targeted person has done or prompted something that would, you know, in any way invite these behaviors that are so bad. But I've seen these ongoing campaigns to basically eliminate someone from the workforce, and then sometimes even following them after they left the organization. It happened to a very dear friend of mine who was a very successful person working for one of the major airlines in Boston, and she suddenly ran into this buzzsaw of a couple of bosses who I think probably had sociopathic or psychopathic type qualities to them. She experienced repeated flat tires in the company parking lot. Things were stolen from her. Interference with some of her online work-related accounts, forms of vandalism and things like that. We had stored some of her personnel records in my office at Suffolk University Law School. One day I opened that drawer and that drawer was empty. Somebody went in and stole the stuff. Because this was an airline, and I happened to fly that airline at the time, no more, once I was subjected to a full-body pat-down by TSA with my bags emptied and searched, and I said, what's going on here? What did I do to deserve this? And after the search was over, the TSA guy bent over and he whispered to my ear. He wasn't trying to scare me. He was trying to give me a heads up, and he says, you can thank XYZ Airline for that one. And it was right after we had engaged in some advocacy on my friend's behalf. So this is the kind of stuff that can get really bad. You know, sometimes when people say my boss is a psychopath, there's actually some science to suggest that could be the case. Studies have shown that the higher up you go on the org chart, the more frequent you see qualities associated with psychopathy. And obviously, the worst of those in this context is a lack of conscience. Think how easy it is to just go and do things to people if you don't have a conscience stopping you. Well, what does this mean on the legal end? About 20 years ago, I said, okay, I'm going to look into the protections for people who have been subjected to generic workplace bullying. And I started by looking at cases in which employees had sued their employers for intentional infliction of emotional distress, and I was stunned by how reluctant the courts were to even let these cases go forward. So many of them were dismissed either through motions, 12B6 motions, or through summary judgment. Generally speaking, unless you can tie the bullying behavior to discriminatory motivations, or in some cases, maybe retaliation for whistleblowing, there's not going to be a lot to stand on in terms of somebody trying to challenge that kind of behavior in a legal context. So what I went and did is I drafted a model statute. We kind of put a happy name to it. We call it the Healthy Workplace Bill. It has been introduced so far in various versions in 30 states so far. It has not been enacted in any state in its full version. However, four states, kind of an odd listing. We got California, we got Utah, we got Tennessee, and Minnesota has a little regulation as well, have taken parts of the template bill language to create obligations for certain types of employers to engage in training and education about workplace bullying. We are making some progress, though. In my home state of Massachusetts, we have had this bill in with the state legislature for the last four or five sessions. There are 200 members of the Massachusetts state legislature, and for the first time this current session, 2019-2020, we now have 103 legislators signed on as co-sponsors. So we are working hard to get that message, you know, sent, and to say that this type of abuse has to have some type of legal safeguard. Now, what's this bill about? Basically, it creates a civil legal claim for those who have been subjected to severe bullying in the workplace. It also creates liability-reducing incentives for employers to act preventively and responsively to bullying. The language is modeled very much after the way in which the Supreme Court has defined a hostile work environment for purposes of sexual harassment, obviously turning into a more generic cause of action that isn't tied to protected class status. And the employer defenses, again, are very much what employers, how employers can avoid or minimize liability under Title VII by having training and education, by having policies that they actually follow. Now, I'm not going to go into the whole thing about how inadequate some of that, you know, that whole discrimination law framework is, but what we're trying to do with workplace bullying is at least get to the point where we're being treated like any other form of severe workplace mistreatment. So, in other words, I think we're sort of at the precipice right now of recognizing this not only as a problem that has to be addressed in terms of human resources and labor relations, where there's a lot more understanding about this dynamic, but also at the level of law and policy. So with that said, I want to sort of tie this back into some bigger picture questions. In preparing for my remarks for this conference, I obviously wanted to do a little deeper dive into what kind of research is available on workplace bullying and individuals with disabilities, especially those who might be visually impaired. And so here's my invitation. There's not a lot out there yet, folks. There is a need for a lot better, deeper research on the effects of bullying on people with disabilities, including those who are blind and visually impaired. And for those of you who have any stories to share, I'd be happy to hear them. My information is available. It's dyamada, at Suffolk, suffolk.edu. If you have information or stories you'd like to share with me, I'd welcome them very much. So we need to make, I think, some stronger ties to the disability community, because obviously this is a challenge that faces folks with disabilities, but we haven't conceptualized it well enough in order to have that piece of it as part of our advocacy. I also think that we need to look at these forms of mistreatment and tie it into just the broader concept of human dignity for all. Sounds a little trite, it sounds a little, you know, sort of pie in the sky, but, you know, if you start talking about dignity in the United States, people just kind of go, what are we talking about? You know, this is U.S., you know, and what I'd like us to do is just say, you know, aren't we entitled to be treated with a baseline of dignity at the workplace? You know, shouldn't that be our starting place? I am affiliated with an organization, it's a network called Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies. It is a global network of scholars, activists, writers, students, you name it, of folks who want to advance the cause of human dignity and reduce the experience of humiliation in our society. In that group as well, I think we are underrepresented in terms of folks from the disability community. And if you have any interest in getting involved with that, please let me know. On a legal end, I'd also like to introduce to you, if you haven't heard of it before, some of you might have, especially if you know my friend Michael Perlin, who's on the NFB board, and that is the concept of therapeutic jurisprudence. Therapeutic jurisprudence is a school of legal thought that posits that when we look at law, policy, and legal institutions, we should be promoting outcomes that are psychologically healthy and that advance individual and collective societal well-being. In other words, we know that there are a lot of political angles in which to look at law and policy. We know there are economic angles. Well, let's introduce the psychological and emotional angle and say that basically how we feel about things and how the law treats us in that realm counts for a lot. So I invite you to consider joining a group that we've just started called the International Society for Therapeutic Jurisprudence. The membership is free for students. It's only $25 for everyone else. I'm the outgoing board chair, but I'll still be very involved with this organization. And one of the reasons why I discovered this therapeutic jurisprudence stuff is because it sort of pulled it all together to me. It said that, you know, for so often or so often in the law, we're talking about certain outcomes that ignore just how people feel after a legally related event. You know, somebody can win their lawsuit and still be in trauma and feel miserable after that result, in part because the litigation experience is just so damn horrific and often re-traumatizing. So what we're looking at is just in very holistic ways, you know, how can we make things better? How can we encourage judges, lawmakers, lawyers to affirm psychological well-being and psychologically healthy outcomes as ways, as goals for the way in which we should be running our legal system? And certainly that ties back in, I hope, very directly to the disability community, disability advocacy. It certainly speaks to me as someone who's been involved in this ongoing campaign to stop abuse at work. I will close now just again with thanks for the opportunity to be part of this conference, with much gratitude to the NFB for this invitation. It's been a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. We began the symposium with a call for a recognition of the importance of therapeutic jurisprudence, and we end that way with the last person to present. Consequently, I don't know whether you were there at the beginning, but your insight to bring the beginning around to the end has worked very nicely. So I thank you very much for that. And I also thank you for the definition, because I was a little unclear before you told me what it was. And I thank the members of the panel. Now, we got to see if there are questions before we get done with this topic. Are there questions from the audience?
I have a question. My name is Caitlin Parton. I'm from Disability Law Center at the Massachusetts PNA. I have a question for Professor Yamada. I'd love to hear more examples of therapeutic jurisprudence that could be incorporated into a resolution, a settlement agreement, things that we should be considering incorporating for our clients, because I absolutely have clients where you finish the case and they have been re-traumatized or going through the experience has really been very deleterious to their own personal health. And I'd just love to hear some more ideas of things that could be done to improve well-being after resolution.
Well, given that you're very close, I hope we can have a conversation that continues after this conference. In a nutshell, obviously, I think in fashioning relief for a client that to look forward as to how to enable that relief to give them the financial and other resources they need to heal, to recover, to move forward is very important. In terms of drafting things, I'll just sort of toss out a phrase to you because I know a lot of legal documents are, sort of canned in some ways, and then we adapt them, right? We do a lot of plagiarism as lawyers. But there's within the therapeutic jurist movement, there are folks who have called for what we call form reform, to look at stock legal documents and to recognize the relationships they create, the language they use, and the obligations or rights they create in ways that we look prospectively to how to, in some cases, heal or at least try to minimize conflicts in the future. So I know that's not a very specific answer to your question, but I'd love to talk to you more about this, perhaps back in Massachusetts. So please come up afterwards and get my card if you don't have my contact information. Thanks a lot for the question.
Good afternoon.
Other questions?
Yes, a question for the professor. I dealt
your
with
name?
Pelayo Duran. I dealt with the issue of bullying in the employment setting, and I was wondering if you have looked into the Restatement Second of Tort, Comment E, which is probably the oldest statute that I could ever find as an employment lawyer dealing with not directly with bullying, but defining bullying in a way, specifically Comment E, which defines the outrageous level of the conduct for purposes of intentional infliction of emotional distress, which, quite frankly, professors do a horrific job of teaching in law school. And as a result, most judges that I have ever encountered says, intentional infliction? Are you kidding me? Isn't that like impossible to prove? Wait, Judge, there's Comment E, and the reason I mention it is because Comment E has paved the way to successfully argue intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is really the only statute, aside from the fact that, and I will comment, is you know, when you bring these cases, usually every conduct that you define, we convert it into retaliation, no? Because it's far easier to prove retaliation than it is to prove intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the absence of a statute is a very serious problem for employment advocates. So I ask you if you...
Yeah, the comments, this is to the restatement of torts.
Correct.
And you're talking about the restatement's definition of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, that's what my initial thought was when I was looking into this. I said IIED has to be the claim that opens the door for targets of workplace bullying to seek relief. And that's when I looked at hundreds of cases from all over the country and saw a lot of reluctance, despite some of that better language of courts to allow that cause of action to go forward. In addition, here's a huge block. In a lot of states, including Massachusetts, where I teach and work, workers' compensation preempts tort lawsuits directly against employers. And so there's an absolute ban of bringing those cases against the employer. And as plaintiffs' lawyers here know, suing individual perpetrators has mixed results, especially in terms of unrecoverable judgments. So the tort law is a possible protection, but it's a very, very limited one.
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions?
Good morning. This is Rebecca Rogers. And I'd like to add on to the discussion about race as addressed by Ms. Rodriguez-Roldan in this panel and by other panelists throughout our conference today. It is not enough for us, for my fellow white people especially, it is not enough for us to be expecting people of color to come to us and raise their issues. We need to be affirmatively reaching out. We need to be the ones who ask what is needed to get involved with the work that is already being done, offer our assistance, and participate in that work by providing our greater, in many situations, resources. Thank you.
Thank you.
And as much as I do not know where to reach, I invite you to join the group that determines so that we can find out where to reach and you can help us learn this. And anybody else who wants to, as I said at the very beginning, we put on this agenda what we thought people wanted on it based upon what we've heard. And if we need different things on it, say so and we'll do them. And if we need to make different plans, bring us the notion and we're open to that. Other questions?
Hi, this is Abigail.
Oh, well, let's find out first if these panel members want to react here. They may have suggestions right off the bat. It'd be nice.
Let's take this this one offline, but I would say that the conference needs more, the movement needs more diversity as a whole. We need to have a greater lineup of speakers of color than a Republican conference. Because that's what it looks like at times. And we need to also work on topics that are more intersectional and so on. The topics have a lot of potential, but we need to work on speakers. Younger speakers under 35, speakers of color, speakers from more diverse organizations and so on. But we can take that offline in deeper, in greater depth.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Abby Graber. On that topic, just briefly, I do think it would be helpful to hear more about what the steering committee is doing. I think we've heard a lot of these comments raised from several conferences past, and the reaction is almost always from the dais, come, well, thank you, bring your friends, come to us, tell us what to do, and it's never, this is what we are affirmatively doing. And I think it would help to know what is affirmatively being done, if anything. I'm sorry to continue to direct questions to Professor Yamada, and I'll admit up front this is maybe more of a comment than a question. But I have some concerns about the private right of action approach to workplace bullying, because what it ultimately is doing, it seems to me, is placing the power to decide what is bullying in the hands of a group of people, namely judges who have not proven trustworthy in adjudicating, for example, what is discrimination. Over the past 40 years, the definition of discrimination has been narrowed significantly from the bench in a way that I think also narrows it culturally, so that anything that isn't, you know, I will not hire this person because he is black, is no longer sort of culturally considered discrimination. And especially if the sort of bullying and judges being older, more white, more male, more successful, less likely to have actually experienced these issues themselves, I worry that going the private right of action route will ultimately, in our culture, narrow what we actually consider to be bullying to the point where it excludes almost everybody's lived experience.
Well, I think your point goes more to the composition of the judiciary than whether we should have legal protections that allow someone who has been mistreated to seek a legal claim. The same concerns that you mentioned have also been documented, as you noted, in discrimination cases. But that doesn't mean we should remove the right to go to court under Title VII or the ADA or ADEA or any of the other types of protective statutes. The reason why I wrote this particular model template in a way that doesn't go through agencies is because we just heard too many nightmare stories of cases sitting for 5 years in places like the EEOC and the state equivalents. And we decided that, like many attorneys prefer to go to court directly, that we'd create a state law, basically a state law claim, and basically the equivalent of a statutory tort claim, rather than funneling it through the agencies. But basically, your point, I agree with it. I mean, I on a pro bono basis, I was just dealing with an employment discrimination case in a state where that in a district that had one of the lowest rates of both EOC proceedings finding reasonable cause and the district courts agreeing with plaintiffs. And the problem, I think, is more systemic, that we don't have enough judges, we don't have enough people in the agencies who get it in terms of how people are being mistreated. I think that's the bigger problem, and any cause of action is going to suffer, unfortunately, because of the lack of what I would call life diversity on behalf of those who are making decisions and legal claims.
Thank you.
All right, further questions? You are?
I'm Nancy Mayer.
Oh, right.
I'm out of Durham, North Carolina, but this is from a prior life when I worked as a union steward on disability issues. Have you worked through any of the unions to find out what they're doing? Because we had grievance procedures, and we would handle a lot of the harassment cases through the grievance procedures, and we would, you know, our focus would be either to get them in another body, you know, each client had a different focus that they wanted, but we would handle it through the grievance procedures, and we found that much more productive than if we ever got to court. I mean, we really tried hard to get it all resolved before it got to that level, and we usually did, but the same issues you're talking about, people's cars getting keyed, I mean, all this kind of stuff, we'd seen it all, and we resolved it through the union, through a grievance process. Have you explored? I'm just thinking you might find a richer set of data using the union grievance procedure than the legal procedure.
A lot of the support that we have for this legislation comes from unions. In Massachusetts, we're working with SEIU NAGE, which is one of the major public employee unions. They not only took some of the bill language and negotiated what they call a mutual respect clause with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that covers bullying behaviors, making it's grievable but not arbitrable. So that's where they are right now with that, and we're getting a lot of data from that. In addition, NAGE has put its lobbyists in the State House on this bill, and we work very closely with them on State House advocacy, and without them we would really be at a much more preliminary stage in terms of trying to move this bill down the field a bit. So I consider the labor movement to be one of our friends on this type of stuff.
Very good. Other questions? I want to thank the members of the panel for this topic on the subject of bullying and harassment, especially with respect to disability. I think it is real, and it's real in many, many places, and I appreciate all of that which you have brought to us and look forward to working in the area in the future.